The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm Siobhan Reardon. I'm President Director here at the Free Library of Philadelphia, and it's, of course, my pleasure to welcome you all here to our Parkway Central Library. If you've not been here before, welcome. I'm sure many of you have been here before. I want to, you know, bit of housekeeping, just make sure you shut off your or silence your cell phones, and I want to remind you there will be a book signing upstairs immediately afterwards as well. As you know, these events tonight, our author series is made possible by the Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation, which is the private philanthropy arm here at the Free Library of Philadelphia. And the purpose of the foundation is to provide support which enriches the library's essential services and quality programs. And so to learn more about the Free Library of the Philadelphia and the work that we're doing, visit freelibrary.org. And, of course, we're always seeking your support in many ways. Tonight, I am absolutely thrilled to introduce two wonderful authors, Anne Enright and Julia Otsuka. Anne Enright shot to international fame with her fourth novel, The Gathering, for which she won the 2007 Man Booker Prize for Fiction and the 2008 Irish Novel of the Year. The Telegraph describes Enright's novels as mosaics of small but captivating details. Her physical descriptions, in particular, are compressed with masterpieces of glancing insight and spiky wit. Her new novel, The Forgotten Waltz, details the journey of lust and desire to drama and discontent. Truly Irish, don't you think? Set in the suburb of Dublin, the novel tracks its heroine through an infidelity that ultimately devastates two marriages and leads to a new life with more complications. Joining her on stage this evening is acclaimed author Julia Otsuka, whose award-winning debut, When the Emperor Was Divine, tells the story of a Japanese-American family's evacuation from their California home to an internment camp during World War II. The Buddha in the Attic, Otsuka's new novel, explores an earlier aspect of Japanese-American history as it weaves the story of a group of Japanese mail-order brides brought to San Francisco in the early 1900s. Publishers Weekly concludes that Buddha in the Attic is a delicate, heartbreaking portrait beautifully rendered. Otsuka's prose is precise and rich with imagery. Readers will be hopelessly engaged and will finish this exceptional book profoundly moved, as did I. It's a pleasure to have both of them here tonight. So ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm Philadelphia welcome to Anne Enright and Julia Otsuka.
Oh, thank you very much. It's really an honor to be here tonight. And I'm going to read from the first chapter of the novel, but for those of you who don't know about Picture Brides, it's a very common first-generation Japanese-American story. Thousands of young women came over from Japan to America in the early 1900s, and most of them were very young girls from poor villages in Japan, and they had not met their future husbands, who were Japanese immigrants who'd come out over a little earlier in the century to work. And by law, these men were not able to marry white women. If you married a white woman, that woman would lose her citizenship. So when it came time for them to marry, they would arrange to have these young brides sent over. So they would exchange photographs and letters and meet for the first time in San Francisco on the dock when the young brides got off the boat. And the entire novel is told in what I call the we voice, the first person plural. There's no main character. And so this first chapter, I'll read a condensed version of it. It's set on a ship bringing over 100-plus young brides. They are traveling in the steerage compartment. And they're in a very kind of dreamy, hopeful state. They've heard very good things about life in America. And the first chapter is called Come Japanese. On the boat, we were mostly virgins. We had long black hair and flat, wide feet, and we were not very tall. Some of us had eaten nothing but rice gruel as young girls and had slightly bowed legs. And some of us were only 14 years old and were still young girls ourselves. Some of us came from the city and wore stylish city clothes, but many more of us came from the country. And on the boat, we wore the same old kimonos we'd been wearing for years, faded hand-me-downs from our sisters that had been patched and redyed many times. Some of us came from the mountains and had never before seen the sea except for in pictures. And some of us were the daughters of fishermen who had been around the sea all our lives. Perhaps we had lost a brother or father to the sea, or a fiancé, or perhaps someone we loved had jumped into the water one unhappy morning and simply swum away. And now it was time for us, too, to move on. On the boat, the first thing we did, before deciding who we liked and didn't like, before telling each other which one of the islands we were from and why we were leaving, before even bothering to learn each other's names, was compare photographs of our husbands. They were handsome young men with dark eyes and full heads of hair and skin that was smooth and unblemished. Their chins were strong, their posture good, their noses were straight and high. They looked like our brothers and fathers back home, only better dressed in gray frock coats and fine Western three-piece suits. Some of them were standing on sidewalks in front of wooden A-frame houses with white picket fences and neatly mowed lawns, and some were leaning in driveways against Model T Fords. Some were sitting in studios on stiff high-back chairs with their hands neatly folded and staring straight into the camera as though they were ready to take on the world. All of them had promised to be there waiting for us in San Francisco when we sailed into port. On the boat, we often wondered, would we like them? Would we love them? Would we recognize them from their pictures when we first saw them on the dock? On the boat, we slept down below in steerage where it was filthy and dim. Our beds were narrow metal racks stacked one on top of the other, and our mattresses were hard and thin and darkened with the stains of other journeys, other lives. Our pillows were stuffed with dried wheat hulls. Scraps of food littered the passageways between berths, and the floors were wet and slick. There was one porthole, and in the evening, after the hatch was closed, the darkness filled with whispers. Will it hurt? Bodies tossed and turned beneath the blankets. The sea rose and fell. The damp air stifled. At night, we dreamed of our husbands. We dreamed of new wooden sandals and endless bolts of indigo silk, and of living one day in a house with a chimney. We dreamed we were lovely and tall. We dreamed we were back in the rice paddies which we had so desperately wanted to escape. The rice paddy dreams were always nightmares. We dreamed of our older and prettier sisters who had been sold to the geisha houses by our fathers so that the rest of us might eat. And when we woke, we were gasping for air. For a second, I thought I was her. Our first few days on the boat, we were seasick and could not keep down our food and had to make repeated trips to the railing. Some of us were so dizzy we could not even walk and lay in our berths in a dull stupor, unable to remember our own names, not to mention those of our new husbands. Remind me one more time, I'm Mrs. Who? Some of us clutched our stomachs and prayed out loud to Canon, the goddess of mercy, where are you? While others of us preferred to turn silently green. And often, in the middle of the night, we were jolted awake by a violent swell, and for a brief moment, we had no idea where we were or why our beds would not stop moving, or why our hearts were pounding with such dread. Earthquake was the first thought that usually came to our minds. We reached out for our mothers then, in whose arms we had slept until the morning we left home. Were they sleeping now? Were they dreaming? Were they thinking of us night and day? Were they still walking 3 steps behind our fathers on the streets with their arms full of packages, while their fathers carried nothing at all? Were they secretly envious of us for sailing away? Didn't I give you everything? Had they remembered to air out our old kimonos? Had they remembered to feed the cats? Had they made sure to tell us everything we needed to know? Hold your teacup with both hands. Stay out of the sun. Never say more than you have to. Most of us on the boat were accomplished and were sure we would make good wives. We knew how to cook and sew. We knew how to serve tea and arrange flowers and sit quietly on our flat, wide feet for hours, saying absolutely nothing of substance at all. A girl must blend into a room. She must be present without appearing to exist. We knew how to behave at funerals and how to write short, melancholy poems about the passing of autumn that were exactly 17 syllables long. We knew how to pull weeds and chop kindling and haul water, and one of us, the rice miller's daughter, knew how to walk 2 miles into town with an 80-pound sack of rice on her back without once breaking into a sweat. It's all in the way you breathe. Most of us had good manners and were extremely polite, except for when we got mad and cursed like sailors. Most of us spoke like ladies most of the time with their voices pitched high and pretended to know much less than we did. And whenever we walked past the deckhands, we made sure to take small, mincing steps with our toes turned properly in. Because how many times had our mothers told us, walk like the city, not like the farm? On the boat, we crowded into each other's bunks every night and stayed up for hours discussing the unknown continent ahead of us. The people there were said to eat nothing but meat, and their bodies were covered with hair. We were mostly Buddhist and did not eat meat and only had hair in the appropriate places. The trees were enormous. The plains were vast. The women were loud and tall. A full head taller, we had heard, than the tallest of our men. The language was 10 times as difficult as our own, and the customs were unfathomably strange. Books were read from back to front, and soap was used in the bath. Noses were blown on dirty cloths that were stuffed back into pockets, only to be taken out later and used again and again. The opposite of white was not red, but black. What would become of us, we wondered, in such an alien land? We imagined ourselves an unusually small people, armed only with our guidebooks, entering a country of giants. Would we be laughed at, spat on, or worse yet, would we not be taken seriously at all? But even the most reluctant of us had to admit that it was better to marry a stranger in America than grow old with a farmer from the village. Because in America, the woman did not have to work in the fields, and there was plenty of rice and firewood for all. And wherever you went, the men held open the doors and tipped their hats and called out, "Ladies first and after you." Some of us on the boat were from Kyoto and were delicate and fair and had lived our entire lives in darkened rooms at the back of the house. Some of us were from Nara and prayed to our ancestors 3 times a day and swore we could still hear the temple bells ringing. Some of us were farmers' daughters from Yamaguchi with thick wrists and broad shoulders who had never gone to bed after 9. Some of us were from a small mountain hamlet in Yamanashi and had only recently seen our first train. Some of us were from Tokyo and had seen everything and spoke beautiful Japanese and did not mix much with any of the others. Many more of us were from Kagoshima and spoke in a thick southern dialect that those of us from Tokyo pretended we could not understand. Some of us were from Hokkaido, where it was snowy and cold, and would dream of that white landscape for years. Some of us were from Hiroshima, which would later explode, and were lucky to be on the boat at all, though, of course, we did not then know it. The youngest of us was 12 and from the eastern shore of Lake Biwa and had not yet begun to bleed. My parents married me off for the betrothal money. The oldest of us was 37 and from Niigata and had spent her entire life taking care of her invalid father, whose recent death made her both happy and sad. I knew I could only marry if he died. One of us was from Kumamoto, where there were no more eligible men. All of the eligible men had left the year before to find work in Manchuria and felt fortunate to have found any kind of husband at all. I took one look at his photograph and told the matchmaker, he'll do. One of us was from a silk weaving village in Fukushima and had lost her first husband to the flu and her second to a younger and prettier woman who lived on the other side of the hill. And now she was sailing to America to marry her third. He's healthy. He doesn't drink. He doesn't gamble. That's all I needed to know. One of us was a former dancing girl from Nagoya who dressed beautifully and had translucent white skin and knew everything there was to know about men, and it was to her we turned every night with our questions. How long will it last? With the lamp lit or in the dark? Legs up or down? Eyes open or closed? What if I can't breathe? What if I get thirsty? What if he is too heavy? What if he is too big? What if he does not want me at all? Men are really quite simple, she told us, and then she began to explain. On the boat, we complained about everything, bed bugs, lice, insomnia, the constant dull throb of the engine, which worked its way even into our dreams. We complained about the stench from the latrines, huge gaping holes that opened out onto the sea, and our own slowly ripening odor, which seemed to grow more pungent by the day. We complained about Kazuko's aloofness, Chiyo's throat clearing, Fusayo's incessant humming of the tea picker song, which was driving us all slowly crazy. We complained about our disappearing hairpins, who among us was the thief, and how the girls from first class had never once said hello from beneath their violet silk parasols in all the times they had walked past us up above on the deck. Just who do they think they are? We complained about the heat, the cold, the scratchy wool blankets. We complained about our own complaining. Deep down, though, most of us were really very happy, for soon we would be in America with our new husbands, who had written to us many times over the months. I have bought a beautiful house. You can plant tulips in the garden, daffodils, whatever you like. I own a farm. I operate a hotel. I am the president of a large bank. I left Japan several years ago to start my own business and can provide for you well. I am 179 centimeters tall and do not suffer from leprosy or lung disease, and there is no history of madness in my family. I am a native of Okayama, of Hyogo, of Miyagi, of Shizuoka. I grew up in the village next to yours and saw you once years ago at a fair. I will send you the money for your passage as soon as I can. Several of us on the boat had secrets, which we swore we would keep from our husbands for the rest of our lives. Perhaps the real reason we were sailing to America was to track down a long-lost father who had left the family years before. He went to work in Wyoming in the coal mines, and we never heard from him again. Or perhaps we were leaving behind a young daughter who had been born to a man whose face we could now barely recall. A traveling storyteller who had spent a week in the village. Or a wandering Buddhist priest who had stopped by the house late one night on his way to Mount Fuji. And even though we knew our parents would care for her well, if you stay here in the village, they had warned us, you will never marry at all. We still felt guilty for having chosen our own life over hers. And on the boat, we wept for her every night for many nights in a row. And then one morning, we woke up and dried our eyes and said, that's enough, and began to think of other things. Which kimono to wear when we landed, how to fix our hair, what to say when we first saw him. Because we were on the boat now, the past was behind us, and there was no going back. On the boat, we had no idea we would dream of our daughter every night until the day that we died, and that in our dreams she would always be three, and as she was when we last saw her. A tiny figure in a dark red kimono squatting at the edge of a puddle, utterly entranced by the sight of a dead floating bee. On the boat, we often stood on the deck for hours with the wind in our hair, watching the other passengers go by. We saw turbaned Sikhs from the Punjab who were fleeing to Panama from their native land. We saw wealthy white Russians who were fleeing the revolution. We saw Chinese laborers from Hong Kong who were going to work in the cotton fields of Peru. We saw King Lee Ivanovich and his famous band of gypsies who owned a large cattle ranch in Mexico and were rumored to be the richest band of gypsies in the world. We saw a trio of sunburned German tourists and a handsome Spanish priest and a tall, ruddy Englishman named Charles who appeared at the railing every afternoon at 3:15 and walked several brisk lengths of the deck. Charles was traveling in first class and had dark green eyes and a sharp pointy nose and spoke perfect Japanese and was the first white person many of us had ever seen. He was a professor of foreign languages at the university in Osaka and had a Japanese wife and a child and had been to America many times and was endlessly patient with our questions. Was it true that Americans had a strong animal odor? Charles laughed and said, well, do I? And let us lean in close for a sniff. And just how hairy were they? About as hairy as I am, Charles replied. And then he rolled up his sleeves to show us his arms, which were covered with dark brown hairs that made us shiver. And did they really grow hair on their chests? Charles blushed and said he could not show us his chest, and we blushed and explained that we had not asked him to. And were there still savage tribes of Red Indians wandering all over the prairies? Charles told us that all the Red Indians had been taken away, and we breathed a sigh of relief. And was it true that the women in America did not have to kneel down before their husbands or cover their mouths when they laughed? Charles stared at a passing ship on the horizon and then sighed and said, sadly, yes. And did the men and women there really dance cheek to cheek all night long? Only on Saturdays, Charles explained. And were the dance steps very difficult? Charles said they were easy and gave us a moonlit lesson on the foxtrot the following evening on the deck. Slow, slow, quick, quick. And was downtown San Francisco truly bigger than the Ginza? Why, of course. And were the houses in America really three times the size of our own? Indeed, they were. And did each house have a piano in the front parlor? Charles said it was more like every other house. And did he think we would be happy there? Charles took off his glasses and looked down at us with his lovely green eyes and said, "Oh, yes, very." On the boat, we could not have known that when we first saw our husbands, we would have no idea who they were. That the crowd of men in knit caps and shabby black coats waiting for us down below on the dock would bear no resemblance to the handsome young men in the photographs. That the photographs we had been sent were 20 years old. That the letters we had been written to us by people other than our husbands, professional people with beautiful handwriting whose job it was to tell lies and win hearts. That when we first heard our names being called out across the water, one of us would cover her eyes and turn away. "I want to go home." But the rest of us would lower our heads and smooth down the skirts of our kimonos and walk down the gangplank and step out into the still, warm day. "This is America," we would say to ourselves. "There is no need to worry." And we would be wrong. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that. It's great to be here, and thanks for coming out. I believe there was some sort of sporting event. I never understand sporting events when there's literature. The beautiful game. This book is about a beautiful game, or a game that seems beautiful to the people who are playing it at the time, or the dance that they're dancing seems beautiful to them at the time. It's about a woman called Gina Moynihan who falls in love. Or you could say it's about a woman called Gina Moynihan who falls hopelessly in love because there's no other way to fall, who throws herself into love as you might throw yourself off a cliff. Or you could say it's a book about an adulterer, a liar, a home breaker, a man stealer. And my personal opinion is which description of the book fits depends on who you are, really. So it's a book for the reader to decide. I met him in my sister's garden in Enniskerry. That is where I saw him first. There was nothing fated about it, though I add in the late summer light and the view. I put him at the bottom of my sister's garden in the afternoon at the moment the day begins to turn. 5:30, maybe. It is 5:30 on a Wicklow summer Sunday when I see Sean for the first time. There he is, where the end of my sister's garden becomes uncertain. He is about to turn around, but he doesn't know this yet. He is looking at the view, and I am looking at him. The sun is low and lovely. He is standing where the hillside begins its slow run to the coast, and the light is at his back, and it is just that time of day when all the colours come into their own. It's some years ago now. The house is new, and this is my sister's housewarming party, our first party, a few months after they moved in. The first thing they did was take down the wooden fence to get their glimpse of the sea. So the back of the house sits like a missing tooth in the row of new homes, exposed to the easterly winds and to curious cows, a little stage set for this afternoon of happiness. They have new neighbours in and old pals and me, with a few cases of wine and the barbecue they put on their wedding list but ended up buying themselves. It sits on the patio, a green thing with a swiveling bucket of a lid, and my brother-in-law, Shay, I think he even wore the apron, waves wooden tongs over lamb steaks and chicken drumsticks while cracking cans of beer high in the air with his free hand. Fiona keeps expecting me to help because I am her sister. She passes with an armful of plates and shoots me a dark look. Then she remembers that I'm a guest and offers me some Chardonnay. Yes, I say, yes, I'd love some, thanks. And we chat like grown-ups. The glass she fills me is the size of a swimming pool. It makes me want to cry just to think of it. It must have been 2002. There I was, just back from 3 weeks in Australia, and mad, just mad, into Chardonnay. My niece, Megan, must have been 4, my nephew nearly 2, fantastic, messy little items who look at me like they're waiting for the joke. They have friends in too. It's hard to tell how many kids there are running around the place. I think they're being cloned in the downstairs bathroom. A woman goes in there with one toddler, she always comes out fussing over 2. I sit beside the glass wall between the kitchen and garden. It really is a lovely house. And I watch my sister's life. The mothers hover around the table where the kids' food is set, while out in the open air, the men sip their drinks and glance skywards as though for rain. I end up talking to a woman who is sitting beside a plate of chocolate Rice Krispie cakes and working her way through them in a forgetful sort of way. They have mini marshmallows on the top. She goes to pop one into her mouth and she pulls back in surprise. Oh, pink, she says. I don't know what I was waiting for. My boyfriend, Connor, must have been dropping someone off or picking them up. I can't remember why he wasn't back. He would have been driving. He usually drove so I could have a few drinks. Which was one of the good things about Connor, I have to say. These days, it's me who drives. Though that's an improvement too. And I don't know why I remember the chocolate Rice Krispies except that, ooh, pink, seemed like the funniest thing I'd ever heard. And we ended up weak with laughter, myself and this nameless neighbour of my sister's. She in particular so crippled by mirth, you couldn't tell if it was appendicitis or hilarity had her so bent over. In the middle of which, she seemed to keel off her chair a little. She rolled to the side while I just kept looking at her and laughing. Then she hit the ground running and began a low charge out through the glass door and towards my brother-in-law. The jet lag hit. I remember the strangeness of it, this woman lumbering at Shay while he cooked on, the hissing meat, the flames, me thinking, is this night time? What time is it anyway? While the chocolate Rice Krispie cake died on my lips. The woman stooped as if to tackle Shay by the shins, but when she rose, it was with a small, suddenly buoyant child in her arms. She was saying, out of there, all right, out of there. The child looked around him, indifferent, more or less, to this abrupt change of scene. 3, maybe 4 years old. She set him down on the grass and went to hit him. At least I thought so. She raised a hand to him and then suddenly back at herself as though to clear a wasp from in front of her face. How many times do I have to tell you? Shay lifted an arm to crack a beer and the child ran off and the woman just stood there, running her wayward hand through her hair. That was one thing. There were others. There was Fiona, her cheeks a hectic pink, her eyes suddenly wet from the sheer la-la-la of pouring wine and laughing gaily and being a beautiful mother /hostess into her beautiful new home. And there was Connor, my love, who was late. It's 2002 and already none of these people smoke. I sit on my own at the kitchen table and look for someone to talk to. The men in the garden seem no more interesting than they did when I arrived, in their short-sleeved shirts and something about their casual trousers that screams slacks. I'm just back from Australia. I remember the guys you see along Sydney Harbour Front at lunchtime, an endless line of them, running men, tanned and fit, men you could turn around and follow without knowing that you were following them, the same way you might pick up a goddamn Rice Krispie cake and not know that you are eating it until you spotted the marshmallow on the top. Oh, pink. I really want a cigarette now. Fiona's children have never seen one, she told me. Megan burst into tears when an electrician lit up in the house. I pull my bag from the back of the chair and idle my way across the threshold, past Shay, who waves a piece of meat at me, through rain-bleached tricycles and cheerful suburbanites, down to where Fiona's little rowan tree stands tethered to its square stake and the garden turns to mountainside. There's a little log house here for the kids made out of brown plastic. A bit disgusting, actually. The logs look so fake, they might as well be moulded out of chocolate or some kind of rubberized shit. I lurk behind this yoke, and I'm so busy making this seem a respectable thing to do, leaning into the fence, smoothing my skirt, furtively rooting in my bag for smokes, that I do not see him until I light up. So my first sight of Sean in this, the story I tell myself about Sean, takes place at the beginning of my first exhalation. His body, the figure he makes against the view, made hazy by the smoke of a long-delayed Marlborough light. Sean. He is, for a moment, completely himself. He's about to turn around, but he does not know this yet. He will look around and see me as I see him, and after this, nothing will happen for many years. There's no reason why it should. It really feels like nighttime. The light is wonderful and wrong. It's like I have to pull the whole planet around in my head to get to this garden and to this and this part of the afternoon and to this man, who is the stranger I sleep beside now. I was going to read a filthy bit, but I haven't got the courage. And I'm just going to tell you, you know, that there's filthy bits in it, and you know. But they're never that filthy, because this is a book about love. And that's not how women talk about love. They start an affair, or they lurch through the beginnings of an affair, and the affair is something they're always trying to stop. It's not something they ever really intend to continue with. There's no plan to it. They're always ending this. It starts off as a one-night stand that isn't really a one-night stand, as it turns out, and then an office romance, and it develops into, hotel, what she calls hotel assignations and fabulous illicit lust that goes on for a while. And then they really try to end it. And one of the turning points in the book is when Gina's beautiful mother, Joan, dies. All mothers are beautiful. There's old photographs in their wonderful 1950s, or in Gina's case, 1960s gear. Her parents, she feels, were glamorous in their crochet hat and her trench coat, going off to Lourdes with her rosary beads in their bag. Anyway, I don't know what else to tell you about the book. It's set during the boom. It's a memory. The affair is a boom time affair, and I just thought it was a great, adultery is a great boom time subject. All that denial and all that having it. Anyway, that's all in the book if you want to read that in your own time. I'm going to read another sad bit. This is after her mother dies. Sean came to the funeral. Now, the affair is over at this stage. I didn't mind. It should have been a tactless thing to do, but it wasn't. It seemed to come from some hidden rhythm in our lives, a better place. He came up in the church porch and gave me a hug. Sean looks like someone too busy to care, but then something happens and he does it all perfectly. The country manners coming out in him, maybe, or the bank manager father, who knew the line between doing something sincerely and doing it well. Sean did it well. The only public gesture between us, the only ritual act of touching, hand on my shoulder, hand to the centre of my back, a one-armed hug, his face in my hair, poor you, he said. Poor Gina. And did not pause to look into my wrecked eyes or to feed on the sorrow in my face, but just went over to hug Fiona and then walked away. the whole sequence perfectly timed and true to what we had become, old comrades in the war of love. My eyes were fine, as it happened. My sister's also. We are neither of us the crying type. We are the sunglasses type. We are the kind of woman who walks out of a funeral service talking about their foundation. Is there a line? I said to Fiona, indicating the underside of my chin. Said it and meant it. And Fiona, who understood completely, said, tiny bit, just there. You're fine. So my makeup was at least properly blended as they loaded my mother's coffin into the hearse and Sean paid his respects in the May sunshine. I looked after him as he walked away. You might even say he trotted, a busy little short arse in a pale summer suit, his arm up for a taxi as soon as he hit the side of the road. Then I hugged the next person. I can't talk about Connor at the funeral. He was great. Connor is great. Anyone can tell you that. He did everything right, except, I suppose, for the way he checked his damn phone every 5 minutes. Don't tell me that thing is online, I said. Duh, he said. Then he looked up at me and stalled, realising where he was. He was wearing his black suit, too tight on him now, his only suit, the one he had been married in, same church, same porch. A little later in the year, the fallen cherry blossom now drifted against the steps and turning brown. Sean rang some weeks later to check that I was okay. I said I was really not okay, and I laughed. He said he knew a good guy if he wanted help selling the house, if you are selling the house. Well, you know, I said. I didn't tell him that I was sleeping in the place or sleeping there some days during the afternoon. As I said, you would think the rooms might have faded, but all her things were just as she liked them. When I came back one day, another day that Fiona couldn't manage, I put my feet up on the sofa for a moment and woke just as dark was starting to fall. What's up with you? I said. Nothing's up. Are you in the dog box? I said, because that's how he used to talk about his marriage. He used to say, I'm in the dog box at home. No, it's not that, he said. But it was something. In the old days, the good old days when we seldom saw each other dressed, Sean did not discuss his daughter. She might crop up towards the end of the afternoon just as he was getting ready to go. Or one day he said, Evie wants a ferret. Can you believe it? Another time, going through his pockets for keys, he said, a lump of Evie's hair fell out. Have you ever seen that? About the size of a twopence, about this wide? He said this sometime in the spring. I know when it was because I remember thinking quite casually, we did that. It was our kiss on New Year's Eve that did this thing to Evie's hair. The calls he made after Joan died were different. He rang as a friend and he talked about his daughter the way you do. Evie was fighting with her mother. Evie threw a pair of shoes under the wheels of a lorry because she wanted to wear high heels. Evie was so spacey, she was always late. Her schoolwork was going to pot, she couldn't concentrate for 2 minutes at a time. I tried to figure out if my niece Megan had started her periods yet. I said, is she eating? Eating, he said, like food. She eats, he said, though he seemed to disapprove of the question. What age is she again? 10. That's a bit early, all right. I told him we thought Fiona had anorexia when she was 16, and this interested him a lot. We brought her to a doctor. Have you brought Evie to a doctor? For what, though, he said. I mean, what would you say? It was a thing we started to do whenever I was over in Terranure, twice, maybe three times in the next couple of months. I sent him a text, and he would call. I slept on the sofa another time, and we talked when I woke. The third time, it was a bit like going back on the cigarettes, actually. I rang as soon as I got in the door, and we had these dreamy walking chats where he led me through this and that to his troublesome daughter, and I moved through my mother's rooms and touched the objects she had left behind. And I don't know if Evie was the reason or the excuse the day he said, maybe that day, the day of the third call, where are you? Are you there now? I'm just down the road. Which is how we ended up making love. Not in my room, but in the bedroom beside it. I opened the front door and he was there, all clear grey eyes in front of a troubled grey sky. I showed him into the house. Funny, he said. What? I thought it would be bigger. It's quite big, I said. We went upstairs. Sure, he said. I mean, this is a very desirable sort of house. He glanced inside the bedrooms, checked out the ensuite, the spare room, the upstairs bathroom. Two in a bit, he said. And then he hugged me because I was trembling. I fended him off at the door to my parents' room and at the one that led to my own childhood bed. We went to the place of least resistance. At least, I think so. I think we fell through the door that felt right. And where, of course, found out. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to Julie Otsuka and Anne Enright for those readings. If you have a question, please raise your hand. We will get a microphone to you. Who would like to start us off? Don't be shy. Gentleman in the third row there.
This is to you, Ms. Otsuka. You made some references to the sixth turbaned man on the ship. I'm curious, was it the way Indians took for coming to America through Tokyo to the West Coast? And also, would you have a fair idea of when did the Japanese immigration actually start to the USA for jobs and other things?
I'm sorry, I missed the first part. I made reference on the ship to?
Turban Sikh people.
To what? Turban Sikh people, yes. And what was the question? Were there actual Sikhs on the ship? Yes, there were. Actually, I did a lot of research for this book, but some of the ship details I got from looking at old newspapers, the shipping lists, they would have very detailed descriptions of the passengers. And many Sikhs were coming over actually to work in the fields. I'm sorry, what were your other questions?
About the Japanese immigration.
Uh-huh.
To USA. When did that happen?
Oh, yes. Between 1908 and 1920 was when most of these women came over as picture brides. But then all Japanese were banned in 1924. So after that, very, very few came in.
Another question? Yeah, lady on our left.
This is also for Ms. Otsuka. I was wondering about how the genre of the sort of immigrant novel genre constrains your writing and how you experiment with it and make it your own. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I don't really feel constrained. I just write about what I want to write about. Uh-huh. So, I mean, I don't personally feel pigeonholed. I mean, I think my next novel will have nothing to do with Japanese Americans and be about something very different, about dementia and swimming, actually. But I feel, you know, as free as I want to feel about form, and I felt, I mean, just using this first-person plural was actually very fun and kind of not experimental, but for me, a different kind of voice to use, and it's kind of odd to be thinking in the wee voice for 8 or 9 years, but It allowed me to tell a much larger story than I think I would have been able to tell if I just focused on one picture bride.
I wonder if you could each talk about the kernel that launched your stories.
The kernel. I don't know. I'm very superstitious or reluctant to talk about beginnings. There are many beginnings to a book. It's not like it just descends or, you know, it's not just one single thing. I wanted to write a book about something that seemed to be terrible but was actually wonderful. Does that make sense? But I had the subject in mind for a long time because I got into so much trouble with The Gathering for it being so miserable in Ireland because it came out during the boom years where everyone was saying, you know, we have to put, that's gone now, you know, we have the handbags and why are you carping on about the bad old days and why is it all so miserable? There was a kind of hectic feeling to the last 5 years of the of the boom, you know, that decade, and a kind of denial that was going on. So I had been thinking how to respond to this very interesting change in Irish society, and I thought, when the place seemed to be awash with money, but it was awash with a kind of belief. You had to believe, because if you didn't believe, then the prices would crash. Because, of course, it was a confidence trick, and all the money would turn into debt. So it was a kind of, you had to believe. I was thinking, is this an economy or is this a religion, you know? And I thought that, I had been thinking that adultery is a really great boom time subject. It's a great subject for society in transition about old mores falling away or being broken down, and people having to make their own personal morality independent of the authority of the church or whatever old of or of family or the, you know, the old values. But on February the 6th in 2009, I made a journey with my family, who annoyed the hell out of me in the snow. I was driving them all in the snow, and they were all telling me now to move into second gear and go a bit faster, go a bit slower, and whatever. But it was an interesting day, and I knew that I was going to set the book on this day of snow where the country was stalled and the economy was in free fall. I just thought there was something very beautiful about the sensation of falling, something very beautiful about the silence after the crash, because I thought that there was an emotion that was coming in, that this was when sort of love could come stealing in, basically, after everything was over. And so I got that it wasn't regret. It was something that felt terrible but might be wonderful as well. And that was maybe. That's what I'm telling you. That,
right. So we'll actually...
That's my story about how I made my story. If so... you can believe it or not.
Julie?
For me, it took me actually a long time to find the kernel or the right voice. I mean, after I wrote my first book, I think I was floundering for about a year and had this idea about picture brides, and also I had the idea for the last chapter, which is very different from the rest of the book. But one day I was just looking through my old notes, and I saw buried many pages in the middle of a paragraph, the sentence, which just kind of popped for me, and it's now the first line of the novel. And the sentence is, "On the boat, we were mostly virgins." And when I read that line, I thought, aha, that would be a great first line for the book and a great voice in which to tell this particular story in the we voice. So I guess, I mean, I don't know, beginnings, I think, are mysterious. They're different every time. Sometimes it's just a line. I can just hear the voice.
I think it's the mostly.
Mostly.
But like, we were mostly virgins.
I mean, I don't really know. I mean,
90%.
So, I mean, sometimes I'll have an idea, but it's not, or I'll have a vague idea of an ending, but it's just kind of a false lure to get me from point A to point B, but I actually end up someplace else just completely unexpected, which is what I kind of like about the writing process. But for me, I think the kernel of the book was just getting the voice.
Mm-hmm. Any more questions? Yes, gentleman in the second row here.
Yes, Ms. Enright, you said that falling in love is always hopeless. And
yes, I was sort of in quotations. That's what Gina would think, for sure.
I think it certainly is that way in your work, which I admire enormously. And I guess that would be in relation to the optimism, the prosperity. Is falling in love something you have to do to find reality when you're living in a situation of prosperity? You need a disaster?
The relationship between love and reality is very much at the center of this book, because love is a sort of unreality, a kind of wonderful unreality. Or the falling is a wonderful unreality. So reality doesn't bite in this book, but it emerges. I don't know. I mean, Gina believes in love, but I think many people do. And it's a wonderful thing to believe in. What else are we supposed to believe in? But I'm quite interested in what people do. We talk endlessly about our intentions and our beliefs. But actually, it's what we do that matters. You know, if someone is nice to you, even if they don't love you, it's probably better than them being horrible to you even and loving you. You know, there is... These things are very interesting. Love, I don't know. I think when you fall in love, the first thing you say is, oh, shit. Oh, shit.
Following
but I, that's not this book.
That's what
you like. Yeah, maybe. Maybe it's the next book, actually.
Lady on the Isle, about five rows back.
The Irish are noted for being such storytellers. When did you decide to write?
I never decided to write. I think it was a group decision. It was a wee decision. I think it's an arranged marriage. I was given a typewriter for my 21st birthday. It was just a given that I would write. And so that's social, for sure, cultural. I was the youngest in my family, so... There's a phrase, every gentleman's family has an artist as a kind of luxury. You know, so when all the others were educated in the, put on track, you know, I was allowed be wild in my, or, you know, I was allowed to do something foolish.
Somehow. What do you mean it was a wee decision, though? Your family, the
typewriter,
really
and
you?
I'm really interested in this wee because, you know, the novel can be so much about the individual in society. I like to write about family. I know that... that's a group mind as well. So I'm just really fascinated, so just really bouncing off the we in okay. This. I remember reading someone said about the gathering, white girl is bereaved and reassesses her life. And it was, and I could really see where that was coming from because whatever country that writer was coming from, they don't do it like that. Mm. It's too individualistic. Do you know what I mean?
No.
Too egotistic.
Oh, I understand that part, yeah. But I'm still a little baffled by the we.
Oh.
That's okay.
I'd have to work on it a bit more.
Julie, was there a we motivating your career, too?
Was there a what?
A we motivating your career, too?
As far as coming to writing...
Well, I'm being a little facetious, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
No, but what was... I know you had studied painting and
were a painter
first.
Yeah, I think I came
first.
To writing fairly... I started when I was 30 after having failed at... trying to be a painter, so. And I think once you fail, I mean, yeah, you can do anything because you really have nothing to lose. So, I mean, I failed utterly as a painter. I was in graduate school, and I just reached this point where I couldn't even put down a mark on the canvas without wiping it away and being sure it was wrong. And I just ended up making myself miserable after a while, and I finally stopped painting for good, and I was working in the evenings as a word processor in New York for a construction management company, and every afternoon before I went in for the evening shift, I'd go to my neighborhood cafe, which I still go to every day, and it's where I wrote both of my books. But I started reading contemporary short stories for the first time, and I just fell in love with the short story form, and I really love... I've always loved to read, but I just love... being immersed in somebody else's story and being completely taken out of yourself. And after a couple of years, I very tentatively tried my hand at writing, and I signed up for some informal workshops. And so I really began writing, I think, in the spirit of play, almost as a lark. I had no intention of becoming a writer one day. It was just something that I liked to do and that seemed to come fairly easily to me, I think more easily than painting ever did. So I don't feel the desire to paint anymore. It's enough really just to look. And I think, for me at least, that writing is just, it's an easier medium for me to handle. I feel like I could always see the paintings in my head that I wanted to make, but technically I could not execute them. And I feel a little bit more at home, I think, with language.
Another question? Lady in the third row here.
Ms. Enright, I would love having you home and sitting around the dinner table. You would just be so much fun.
I'm not
and
drunk.
So interesting.
Less fun.
Next time, let me know.
No.
I think I don't have a question, really, but I wanted to make a comment to Ms. Otsuka for her marvelous book. It really helped to put into place for me some experiences that I never understood. I came to the U.S., excuse me, at the age of 17 to start college. So I didn't come over on a boat, and I didn't have anywhere near the experiences that the picture brides did, and by a long shot. But it was interesting to me for so long that I was sort of a misfit growing up in Japan as the result of a child of mixed heritage, and then coming to the States and being treated rather rudely by white Americans. And I wasn't very political, so I didn't understand that. But as a result of having read your book, I'm sort of able to put some context around that a little bit more, and your later chapters a bit helped to put that in place. But it really was, for me, a very moving book, and some of it I could feel almost viscerally. I was dreading the young ladies' arrival in the States. I wanted to warn them, it's not what you think it's going to be. And certainly it wasn't as I thought it was going to be either. But thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I think...
It was just wonderful.
Thank you. And I'm glad that it resonated with you. And I think the problem for many of these young women was that they came to America and they were both invisible and at the same time highly visible, and that they stood out, as definitely ethnically being other. And I think most of those women never, ever felt at home in America. I think it was only when they began having families, children of their own, that they began to feel a little bit more at home with their husbands and with themselves. But I think many of them were probably homesick for their mothers and for Japan till the day that they died, and most of them never made it back home. But I also think it's just terribly brave to, I don't know if you came here of your own free will or if you were sent here for school, but I visited Japan, the tiny village where my father grew up years ago, and it was a tiny little silkworm village in the mountains, and I was shocked at how other and how non-Western it was, and just the vast distance that he'd come to get here to this shore. So, I think Japan and America are so, Japan is like, it's another planet, and just a completely different mindset. Also, the idea of love is very, I think, at least for these young women, was utterly foreign. You don't marry for love. You marry really, and maybe love or an affair might be a means to a better life. And people didn't marry, it was often not their own choice. So love might be something that you stumbled upon by accident, perhaps. I think at your own peril, and some of these brides did in fact have affairs or ended up running away or drifted into prostitution, but life was not easy for them if they tried to break out of the mold, and yet if they stayed within the mold, I think life was also extremely difficult because I think many of them felt really estranged from their husbands.
Thank you very much. Before we end, I wanted to just throw one thing to both of you, just that's more of a technical question. If you could both talk a bit about the rhythm of your prose and the editing process, because you both, to my mind, when I read the books, were very rhythmic writers in terms of dialogue and in terms of your the repetition to sort of drive home the point of their alienation and just burrow into their lives. And if you could just talk about rhythm in writing.
I found myself defending myself against the question, why do you write women who aren't very likable, right? So the question of likability is interesting to me at the minute. Why women should be liked, or why they should be... you know, why that's a quality we admire in women so much. But to me, the kind of the content of their thoughts is neither here nor there. It's a given. It's kind of easy to me. What I'm working at is the underlying cadences. I'm trying to make it beautiful, and what I'm working with is certainly in this book a highly oral first person narrative. So I'm trying to keep the cadences of speech, to keep it really direct, so the reader is engaged by it on a really immediate sort of level. And I'm trying to also make it beautiful and hold it, you know. And if I have the cadence right at the end of the paragraph, I can leave that paragraph then and move on to another one. So to me, all the emotion is almost all the emotion is in the rhythm, or emotion or beauty, put it that way, or pathos, or permanence, or the whole aesthetic thing is in the rhythm for me. Yeah, and all the social stuff about, you know, handbags or not handbags is just my stuff, you know. It's just what's available to me. It's just what a woman who grew up in that house, and I know these people, and I can write that. But I'm trying to push the rhythms.
You can feel it when you read it. How about you, Julie?
Yeah, I mean, for this book, I was obsessed with the rhythm of the language. I feel that my first book, because of my training in painting and in sculpture, came to me very much in pictures. I often had to see a scene in my head before I could begin to describe it. But this book, I was obsessed with where the accents fell. I could often, and I was also constantly reading it aloud to myself as I was writing it. And I could sometimes hear the rhythm of the next sentence before I knew the words to drop into that rhythmic pattern. So it was, the rhythm for me was everything. It was like this secret underground grid that kind of held everything in place.
I find it a danger also that you can become enthralled to the rhythm, so that you're writing and you know you have to go, you know what the end of that sentence is. And sometimes I just write da 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 dee da. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. If I'm in a hurry, and then you have to pull back and see, actually, maybe the content is important, that any old words won't cut it, you know. Mm. So it's a balancing act as well.
Between the two. Yeah. Well, the content's fascinating. The writing is intense, precise, beautiful. These are great books by very talented writers, and I would urge you to look at them both. Please thank Julia Tsuka and Anne Enright.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It's lovely. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.